Hello, and welcome to the Get Started with Film Photography podcast. My name is Graham Young. This is the May 2019 question and answers show, and I have gotten so many good questions, I've had to divide this up into two separate halves. After you've completed the first show, go ahead and go to the second show. And I just want to remind everybody, if you have any questions about film photography, you can send me an email, graham@getstartedwithfilm.com, or you can go to the website, getstartedwithfilm.com, and fill out the form on that site. That will certainly work. Anchor has just started a new service for people who don't have the Anchor app on their own phone. And that is if, just by clicking the link that you'll find in my show notes, just by clicking that link, you will be able to send me a message directly, and then I can use your voice actually on the show. So if you have a question that you would like to ask about film photography and you would like to ask it in person using your own voice, you can use that feature by clicking on the link in the show notes and recording a question. My first question for this month's episode actually came to me from a former student. Now, about 3 years ago, I did an alternative process photography class, a film photography class, and started a club when I was teaching at the Art Institute of Jacksonville. I helped many of my now former students find cameras, and one of my students sent me a message about 3 weeks ago, and this is the question. My light meter seems to be way off all of a sudden. Do I need to replace my camera? So this came from Jessica, one of my former students. So my first thought immediately goes to the battery in that situation. And I worked with her and we did solve it, and it was the battery. So it had a fresh battery in it when she got it about 3 years ago. And I know that because I actually put the battery in that camera. So there are a couple of things, and the battery just needed replacing, and she was lucky enough that the battery that she needed to replace it with was one of the 1.5 volt alkaline batteries, a little button battery, and that is available at pretty much every drugstore in North America and probably throughout the world. If there are button batteries available, this little button battery that she needed was one of those batteries that's available. So what you do is you just take it out, look at the little number. There'll be a number on one side, and take it to the store and just match it up with the number. That worked because her camera was relatively recent. It was an 80s or a 90s camera. Cameras that are older than that used the old Mercury 1.35 volt batteries. And the thing about those Mercury batteries is that they were really good. They lasted forever, and they kept a very steady voltage. It was a great battery to use. The only problem was, of course, that the mercury is toxic. And if we put it in a landfill, it gets in the food chain, and it's just really not a very good thing to do. So there are a couple of alternatives if you're in that situation. There is a wine cell, and wine is spelled W-E-I-N, and the wine cell is a little adapter, a little battery that it works at 1.35 volts, and you can find them online. Just do a Google search for wine cell, and again, that's W-E-I-N. Another way to go, if you go back near the pharmacy area in any drugstore, you're going to find a hearing aid battery section. Now, there's a type of battery that uses that 1.35 volts again. It is a zinc air hearing aid battery. And those zinc air hearing aid batteries will keep that 1.35 volt setting throughout their lives. The problem is that they only last about a month. But they're very cheap, and they're sold in 8-packs. They have these little circular dispensers, these little 8-packs. So you can get, you know, essentially half a year's worth of batteries if you use your camera very often. Half a year's worth of batteries for about the same price as it would cost you for an alkaline battery. The big thing is that zinc air batteries need to be kept away from the air, because the air is part of the reactive system in a zinc air battery. As soon as you peel away the sticker, you're starting its lifetime countdown. So I would make sure not to peel away that sticker until you're putting it right in the camera. And I've used those quite often, and I keep a set of them in my camera bag for when I need them. Now, often those batteries are not exactly the right size left to right. Like, they have a different diameter in that disc form, but they're about the right thickness for the battery that I need. And so what I found is if you just put them in there, put them in that case, in that area, and put the cap back on it, it works perfectly fine, even though it's not exactly the right diameter. If you have a camera where you need that to be pressing against an edge, you can, you know, take a little piece of paper and run it around 2/3 of that battery and push it against the edge, and it will work. Or another thing is, you want it only to touch on the bottom and on the top. You don't want it to touch on the edges. And then you just run a little piece of paper all the way around that. I found both of those kludges to work quite well, and you shouldn't find too much problem with using the wrong diameter battery. Now, there are also some other adapters for batteries. So depending on the battery that your camera takes, you might have to search out the name of the battery and the word adapter, and most likely there's one available. There are many little machined adapters that are available on eBay. Another option you have for those old Mercury 1.35 volt batteries, and that is you can just throw in a 1.5 volt battery, and don't worry about it. Of course, your meter is going to be off by a little bit, and it's not a linear progression. In low light, you're off a certain amount, and in higher light, you're off a different amount. It's not a nice linear progression like you would like it to be. But that's okay. That's not a problem at all. Most film will have enough latitude to compensate for how much the light meter is off in those situations. Now, you want to make sure you are not shooting color slide film in those situations. There are two different kinds of button batteries out there. There are alkaline batteries and there are silver batteries. Alkalines will be, you know, P35A, and silver will be P35S. I've just made up those numbers. Don't look for a P35. The advantage of the alkaline batteries is that they are cheap, but the problem is, at the end of their lives, the voltage falls off. So one of the ways that you can deal with that voltage fall off, those batteries will last a couple of years easily. However, if you replace them once a year on your birthday, that's the best way to do it. You can remember, on my birthday, I replaced the batteries in my cameras. Then you'll never get to that fall off. And that works quite well. Now, the other ones are silver-based. The disadvantage is they're more expensive, but the advantage is they have a much flatter curve over their lifetimes. They don't start to trail off anywhere near as early as the alkaline batteries do. One last note on batteries. Each battery type is often available under different numbering systems for different brands. Say you have a PX25 battery. All you have to do is go to Google and type in PX25 battery, and you'll find all the different compatibility numbers. And you can even type in compatibility. And you can find batteries from off brands that work just as well. And I hate to say it, if you work for a battery company, just cover your ears and go la la la. I buy cheap batteries. I buy the cheapest batteries I can find. I've found that they work just as well. Okay, my second question is actually from another podcaster. And in fact, I have another podcaster, a different podcaster, whose question I'm going to answer a little bit later on. But this is Aid from the Sunny 16 podcast. And I highly recommend the Sunny 16 podcast. It's one of my favorite podcasts out there. One of the things that they do a lot is they talk a lot about the art of photography and a lot about conceptual photography. And they're not as devoted to the equipment, to the gear, as some of the other podcasts out there. They really talk about the art. And there are three of them on the show, and they do really well. And I was actually on the Sunny 16 podcast as a guest a couple of weeks ago. And one of the hosts, Aid, he asked me this question. How do you load film into your camera? And, you know, I laughed when he asked that, because that is one of the really basic questions that I, you know, I probably would not have thought of answering. One of those things that I would not have thought of bringing up as an issue at all. But really, that's an important thing. If you are a digital photographer, or if you're an iPhone photographer, loading film into a camera is a difficult thing, especially if you've never done it before. So, if you want to listen back to the episode that I was on, that was episode 150 of the Sunny 16 podcast. But let's talk about the question. I'm going to sidestep it a little bit, and I'm going to talk about how to find out how to load your camera. Every camera is a little bit different. There are some generalities about camera loading, and I'm going to talk about some specifics and some principles of camera loading that that will be universal across all cameras. But each camera is a little bit different. So the first thing I'm going to do is sidestep the question, and I'm going to tell you, go get the manual for your camera and read it. If you are lucky enough to get a manual with your camera, you'll have it there and you can reference it easily. But most cameras don't come with manuals. So how do you get the manual? I'm going to send you to a website. It's www.butkus.org, and it's B-U-T-K-U-S, butkus.org/Chinon, /. Now, you can use pretty much any camera brand in that slash. For some reason, he has it going to Chinon by default, but you'll get the full listing of all the different camera manufacturers. Then you can go in and you can get your particular model. It sometimes takes a bit to find your model, and you may have to Google to see it, whether or not your model was sold under different names in different markets, because sometimes it was the blah, blah, blah in one market, and it was the yada, yada, yada in the other market. So you might have to search around to find out what the equivalent camera is. If you can't find the exact one, look for one with a similar model name or a similar model number. Like, I have a Minolta X370. If I couldn't find the X370 manual, I would go and find the X570 manual. That's the next one up. Or the X700 manual. And do that type of thing. But go to butkus.org/Chinon and look for the manual for your camera. Now, I usually get the manual after I have bought my camera and it's in the delivery process. I love reading the manual before I get the camera, just to see what it can do. Many cameras have hidden features that you're going to never know about without the manual. In fact, a little bit later on, I'm going to be talking about one of those hidden features. Many auto everything cameras from the 1990s have a ton of features, and they are including automatic loading systems. So definitely go get the manual and read it for your camera. Most cameras load fairly easily. Some of them have automatic systems that are easy to use once you know the trick, but you have to know the trick, and sometimes they're a mystery until you know the trick. So once again, go to that manual and check it out for your particular camera. Now, after you've loaded the film, it's very important to make sure that the film is advancing. Some cameras have a load confirmation window. Minoltas have this little horizontal slit window. And if it has black and white stripes going across it, that means it is... I might have this backwards. If it has black and white stripes going across it, it means that it is not properly loaded or it's empty. But if it has a little red stripe, a little red marker that advances as you go through the film, it's properly loaded. It's one or the other, and once again, I don't remember off the top of my head. Now, there is another way to assure yourself without those little confirmation windows, and that is if your camera has manual advance and manual rewind. That means you've got, you take a picture, you have a wind on lever, and when you're at the end, you have to find the clutch to press, and then you rewind the film. That's a manual advance camera. If you have one of those, what I do is as soon as I've attached the film and I've advanced it once and closed the door, then I tighten up that rewind so that it is tight against that film, and then I click the shutter and advance the film again. And if my little rewind knob goes forward, you know, if it's moving, if it spins as I wind it, then I know I have film in it. In fact, that's one of the ways that I check to see whether I have film in a camera or not, is go to the rewind button and rewind it. If I get tension on there, I have film in my camera. And if I don't get any tension, then I don't have film in my camera. I want to talk a little bit about film advance systems. They usually comprise two things. One of them is the take-up spindle, where you pull your film over and it winds into a nice spool of film as you advance. And then there is a set of sprockets that is right next to the film gate, and it sits between the film gate. The film gate, again, is the opening where the image is taken. That's the film gate. So it's right in between the film gate and that take-up spindle. The thing that actually advances the film is that sprocket. That sprocket actually advances the film, and it's not that take-up spindle. In fact, the take-up spindle has a little bit of a clutch, usually. They both advance, but their clutch makes sure that that take-up spindle doesn't pull on the film more than a full frame. And that sprocket is the part that determines how far it actually advances, and that is measured out in the number of sprockets that a full frame sprocket holds that a full frame image takes up. So as you advance the film, that spindle does turn to wind that film on, but it is the sprocket that actually pulls the film out of the canister, and that's the part that you have to make sure is properly attached. Now, you have to make sure that the film is properly attached to the take-up spindle, that the film goes over those sprockets properly. Some of the late 1990s auto everything SLRs did not have sprockets. They had a take-up reel that it pulled the film out of the canister. And the thing about it was they were actually measuring how many sprockets would pass a sensor. And it is an infrared sensor, so it does not expose your film unless you're shooting infrared. So be very careful about infrared film and late 90s auto everything SLRs and auto everything point and shoot cameras. But though that sensor would figure out how far that film had been advanced, and that's what would be the measurement. So you may not have sprockets in later plastic auto everything cameras. I'm going to go ahead and take a break at this point, and I'll be right back. Our third question comes from Meg Boone on Instagram. And Meg Boone's Instagram is meg.underscore Boone, B-O-O-N-E. So that is Meg Boone on Instagram. Her question is, Kentmere film is pretty inexpensive compared to others. Is it still good film or not worth spending the dollars on? Should I buy more reputable film? I think that this is a great question, and it talks about the idea of what a quality image is, and it talks about whether or not the materials that you're using are cost-dependent and quality-dependent. The first thing that I'm going to say is there is a wide difference in film that's being made today. I will not say whether it is worth the money or not worth the money, because in that wide spread of different emulsions and different price points, there are films that you're going to like and there are films that you're not going to like, or you're going to not like. Let's say that. I don't think it is a cost versus quality association. Every new emulsion that is put out today, and what I mean by new emulsion is fresh emulsion, every fresh film that is put out today is a quality manufacturer. And I don't think that there's anybody getting ripped off by quality at all in any way with any film. The question is, do you like the result? That is entirely the result of your subjective eye. Do you like the film? Let me talk a bit about Kentmere and why she asked the question about Kentmere. Kentmere is a film that is made by Ilford, or Harman Technologies is actually the manufacturer of Ilford branded films. And it's sold as their budget brand of film. Rumor has it that another brand of film, Ultrafine Extreme, is rebadged Kentmere, but they don't actually say that, but it's a very strong rumor, and I've heard it all over the place. And I use Ultrafine Extreme all the time because it really is. It's the cheapest film that I can find, and it is a quality product. So really, if Kentmere works for you, I'm going to say Ultrafine Extreme works for me, and it's at that same budget point. So whether it's the exact same film or not, I can't say. It's been a long time since I shot any Kentmere. I shot some Kentmere about 2014, the last time I bought some. And I came across Ultrafine Extreme, which is the cheap film in the United States. Kentmere is actually cheaper in England and cheaper in the EU. Because of its location and manufacture. Now, it does actually tell me one thing that I do want to talk about as well. And that is that we can never talk, especially about black and white films, we can never talk about black and white films without also talking about the developers that we use to develop them. There are bad developer combinations. One thing I do know is the Film Photography Project store has a brand of Monobath. Now, Monobath is a liquid that has the developer and the fixer in it together. And so all you have to do is run the film through that fixer and developer combination, and you're done. You don't have to switch things out, and then, of course, you do have to wash it at the end. But you don't have to swap things out. Well, Ultrafine Extreme and the Monobath from the Film Photography Project, they don't get along at all. And some of the negative is not developed. And so avoid that combination. And the only thing that I'm going to tell you about something like using Kentmere or Ultrafine Extreme, that is, check it out. Try it out. Make sure that you can see whether or not it works with your developer. If you find it doesn't work with your developer, I'm going to suggest that you change developers. If you if it doesn't work the first time, go ahead and see if a second developer will work. If that doesn't work, try a third developer. And if none of those three developers work, and you found that, you know, there is a combination of film and that one of those three developers does work for you, stick to the one that does work for you, or try something else. So it's really subjective to your eye. Do you like the results? If you like the results with Kentmere and somebody else is shooting some, I don't know, some Kodak T-Max film, and you're shooting and getting results that you like, and he or she is shooting and getting results that he or she likes, then guess what? You're both winning. You just are paying a little bit less. Or maybe you're paying more because you found that you really love that T-Max film in T-Max developer. So I just want to bring full circle this question, and that is, you need to try out the film and the developer together and see whether or not it works. I'm one of those people, I'm locked into using one developer because I'm on a septic and well system. So I use Extol because it is a very low toxicity developer. And I dispose of it at the landfill. I don't even pour that down my drain. I just wanted to say that I'm locked into that developer. So there are many good developer film combinations that I can't use because of how I'm locked into one developer. So, you know, be okay with the fact that maybe the film that you just chose to try out doesn't work with your developer. My next question comes from James Haar. And James Haar is on Instagram at J-E-V-H-A-R-R. J-E-V-H-A-R-R. His question is, can I buy a Canon lens and use it on my Nikon camera? What about Sigma or Vivitar lenses? This is, again, a great question. I love these questions that are coming in because I never really would have thought of having to go through this. But generally speaking, you're not going to be able to use a Canon lens on a Nikon camera, especially if you're using one of the autofocus models and an autofocus lens. Now, the reason for that is Canon and Nikon are competing companies, and they both make camera bodies and camera lenses. And so the lens mount, the way the lens mounts to the camera is different on the two systems. And in fact, they have different communication systems, a little different electronic connections. So they are not going to be able to work one on the other. Now that's my general no, but there are a couple of caveats. The first one is every lens mount system. So if you're a Pentax K mount, your Minolta MD or the Minolta Maxim mount, which is now the Sony mount, and there are actually multiple Sony mounts now that I think about it. And I'm not up on the Sony mount, so if I've improperly characterized those, don't kill me because I'm not up on Sony. But then there, you know, for Canon, there's the Canon FD mount, which was the old, and there was also an FL mount, and these are old manual focus cameras. But then they came out with the EOS mounting system, and those are the autofocus mounts. Well, with every one of those combinations, and there are many more combinations, with every one of those combinations, there is a specific distance the back of the lens sits from the film plane. So that's called the flange focal distance. And Nikon has a particularly long flange focal distance. So there is a possibility that you could fit between the lens and the Canon body, we're talking old manual focus Nikon lenses on a Canon body, there's enough room to fit an adapter. Now, I don't know if there were any adapters made or not. So you may have to actually, you know, you can make an adapter yourself. They're not that complicated. In order to get them to work, you know, and have the electronics and the automatic aperture stop down, that's complicated. But you can just hold a lens in front of a camera, especially in SLR, because you're looking through that lens. That particular thing, just holding that lens out there in front of the camera body, is they call that free lensing. And you could actually free lens with a Nikon lens. Or you can find an adapter, or you can make a cardboard one. Make sure you hold on to both the camera and the lens all the time if it's cardboard. But you can, the idea is you just have to find out how far away you have to move that lens, and then it will work to a certain extent. You may not be able to stop down on automatic aperture lenses, but you could use it. You could get images. You may be shooting wide open, but you could get images. So Canon or Nikon lens on a Canon body, generally I'm going to say no, not worth the pain and the effort. But if you have a Nikon lens and a Canon body, why not try it out? You know, an adapter is going to be cheaper than buying another lens in many cases, not always. Now, the other question was, what about Sigma or Vivitar lenses? And the answer to that is yes and no again. Yes, if you have a Canon body and you buy a Canon mount Sigma lens or a Canon mount Vivitar lens, then yes, you can absolutely use it. The brands at that point don't matter for compatibility. Sigma and Vivitar are makers of lenses, or actually Vivitar, as I understand, is actually just a rebadger of other people's lenses. But they are makers and sellers of lenses that are compatible with many different camera systems. They're called aftermarket lenses. And so, yes, you may find a Sigma lens for your Canon camera. You may find a Vivitar lens for your Canon camera, or for your Nikon, or for your Pentax, or for your, whichever brand, whichever camera that you have. There are other companies that you might find that you can find a lens from. Tamron, Tokina, Samyang, which also sells the Rokinon and the Bauer nameplate. And then there's a new company called Seven Artisans. And Seven Artisans is a Chinese company that makes very inexpensive lenses that work on, say, Leica cameras and all of the current digital cameras. You can find a Seven Artisans lens for. And they're very popular because they hit a very, very low price point. Now, the deal is that you have to verify what mount that particular lens is. So if you're buying from a store, you would say, I want a Sigma in a Canon mount. I want a Vivitar in a Nikon mount, or whatever combination you're working on. If you're buying it off of eBay and there is no mount listed, I'm going to skip it. I'm going to skip it. Because, yeah, you can look at that lens, and if you have the right eye, you can figure out which mount it is. But you can also go wrong. So if they don't tell you what mount that lens is, I would skip it on eBay. This is the end of the first half of the May 2019 Questions and Answers show. The second half will be coming along shortly, so look for it soon. If you are on Instagram, you can follow the feed of the show at GetStartedWithFilm. If you hashtag your posts, GetStartedWithFilm, I have a pretty good chance of seeing your work and I might feature it in the show's feed. Our music comes from filmmusic.io. This track is Poofy Reel by Kevin McLeod of Incomptech.com. and it's licensed through Creative Commons.